Hey, and welcome to the Two Quarterback Experience. This is episode 15, the Andy Dalton Experience. All redheads all the time. I am Joshua Lake on Twitter at Lake2QBs, here with my usual co-host, Greg Smith, who is at Greg Sauce on Twitter. My favorite part of his Twitter bio is beard canvas, so why don't you just elaborate on what exactly that means, Greg?
That means that my beard is an untamable mess. It is the one part of my body that fits the all redheads all the time stereotype, though. So on that note, I think we're good to go.
Perfect.
The red beard.
And on the other line, we are very thrilled to have Evan Silva with us. He's, as you all know, on Twitter at Evan Silva. He's the senior football editor for Roto World. And one question we don't know the answer to came from a Twitter user is, if Evan Silva could be an animal, what kind of animal would he be? So how are you, Evan? And then what kind of animal?
I'm doing well, and I never even thought about what animal I would be. I guess I'd be a shark.
Nice.
That's very fitting.
Yeah. No,
been going to Cape Cod since I was a little kid, and I mean, I have, like, they have like sharks, actual sharks at Cape Cod. I mean, you know, every once in a while there'll be like, you know, a shark will bite someone, but I've always been like afraid of them. But yeah, that's what I would be. They're like, you know, they're like dinosaurs.
They're really cool. We just went to the aquarium not that long ago. My son's 3, and I think he's had nightmares of sharks for the solid week now.
Yeah. When I was about 7, I was actually at Cape Cod, like right on the beach, and down the road in a cottage, in another cottage down the beach, I went and watched Jaws. And man, it was about 4 years until I ever went back in the water.
I'm sure that's one of those movies you don't forget.
Right.
Great movie.
Well, we are really thrilled to have you on and really appreciate your time. I know this is a very busy season for you guys over at Roto World. I find myself hitting refresh all the time looking at the news, and I can only imagine on the back end of things. So really appreciate it.
Definitely.
So we wanted to kind of jump off from all of the fantasy team previews that you've been writing over the offseason and focus primarily on quarterbacks. And I'm sure most of our listeners have already seen them, but you've been breaking down one team at a time, looking at kind of the entire team, not just the quarterback position. So we're just going to tease out some of the quarterbacks. But I thought another Twitter question was from Ben Cummins. He had said that as you're writing all these previews and really getting into depth for each team, he was wondering if you've changed your mind on players as you've done them, or if you have any examples of specific players that you've either gotten higher or lower on once you really dug into the numbers.
Yeah. And one guy stands out a little bit. And I mean, I still have him as a top 5 quarterback, and I think that he will finish there in terms of his season-long ranking. But it's Drew Brees. And it's a guy who I opened the offseason drafting him in my MFL 10s pretty much any opportunity that I could, because he was following the 7th and 8th round. And I mean, I love his weapons. One thing that I did kind of a study early in the offseason, and I was looking at what factors lead to big games for quarterbacks. And one of the things that I found was that it would be like the quarterback would very often be at home. He would very often be favored. He would be in a situation where he would be very comfortable. Those are situations where, the quarterback is in position to have a really, really big week. Well, and one thing that we know about Drew Brees historically, and I mean, this is in a big sample size now, is that he's a pretty average fantasy quarterback on the road, but he is lethal at home. Saints have a tough schedule period this year, but I looked at his home schedule and it's pretty friggin' worrisome. In week 1, they face the Raiders, who I think could have a top 10 defense this season. In week 3, they face Atlanta. I think I'll be using Drew Brees in DFS that week. but then they face Carolina comes to New Orleans, Seattle comes to New Orleans, Denver goes to the Superdome, LA Rams, and it's not again until week 13 I would pinpoint a game and be like, you know what, I want to use Drew Brees this week, and it's against the Lions, but that's not until week 13. So, you know, I still have him as a top five season-long quarterback. I love his weapons, but I've really backed off drafting him, and I've just decided to go with, you know, especially in my MFL 10s, 12th, 13th, 14th, maybe 15th round quarterbacks, as opposed to using, you know, a 7th or 8th round pick on Drew Brees, because I'm not sure that, based on, you know, the evidence that we have, that he's going to be a great bet for his usual monster games this season.
Hmm. And that was going to be my question, is if you mm-hmm. still have him in the top five, mm-hmm. it sounds like he hasn't moved relative to other quarterbacks as much as he has just where you would take him overall.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I you know, again, I wanted to be aggressive on him early, because all the quarterbacks have started to really fall down the board just because people are getting smarter in one quarterback leagues, of course. I mean, I still have him right above Ben Roethlisberger, but he's not, like, close to Cam Newton and Aaron Rodgers and even Andrew Luck and Russell Wilson for me anymore.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is interesting. Because I remember listening to you guys talking about your tiers, and that Brees was originally in that first tier. And so just mm-hmm. hearing how that thought process has transitioned is really interesting. Greg, where do you have Brees right now? What's your evaluation of him going into the year?
Brees is my QB5 as well. I have him behind those top four that Evan mentioned. For me, the gap wasn't really that big, not as big as Evan's talking about, but you know, Evan might be opening my eyes here. I just pulled up the schedule while he was talking, and yeah, I mean, it's pretty brutal. Evan, I wanted you to expand on one thing that you kind of noted at the beginning of your conversation starter there. You talked about quarterbacks generally being comfortable. Have you seen that extend beyond home and away types of splits, like maybe in terms of repeat opponents or common opponents for certain quarterbacks, maybe not necessarily with Brees and the Saints, but with other QBs?
Well, I know that Joe Goodberry, who's a really good football analyst, I think he writes for like Cincy Jungle on and off and on. He talks about the uncommon and common opponents for Andy Dalton, and how Andy Dalton fares very well against uncommon opponents, but not nearly as well against common opponents. I mean, I haven't done any research myself on, you know, whether that applies, you know, for different quarterbacks. And I think that would be a great research project probably for somebody to take up. I think you can kind of almost see it on the field. You know, when you think of an uncomfortable quarterback, you think of a guy like maybe like Sam Bradford or Alex Smith when he was with the 49ers. And then when you think about a comfortable quarterback, you think about Joe Montana or Tom Brady. You know, I think that comfort is important, and I think that you can see it in the numbers, essentially, if that makes sense.
Right. No, it does. And one of the other things that you had mentioned was talking about like DFS and who you're going to play week to week. And when you have those kind of Jekyll and Hyde quarterbacks, whether it's Brees or Dalton or others, in DFS, you can exploit that a lot more than in season long, particularly in a two quarterback league where you can't just dump somebody and pick someone else up quite as easily.
Right.
And so it does change your evaluation, where one might be an elite DFS option, but in season long, you're going to downgrade him. One thing that you said about the Saints' weapons triggered in my mind. When you're looking just purely at the quarterbacks and how you rank them, how much are you thinking about the weapons around them, the game plan, things like that, versus the quarterback, just his talent, his comfort level, things like that? Obviously, impossible to quantify it, but how does that balance shake out for you? We talked about on a past episode, Greg and I did, can a quarterback elevate his team? Can his team elevate him? Where do you stand on kind of that interplay?
Yeah, it's a really interesting debate. For me, like over the years, you know, just doing this for a long time, I think that supporting cast is maybe one of the biggest factors. Let's just take last year, for instance. Aaron Rodgers, you know, loses Jordy Nelson, still finished as the quarterback 7 overall. But, I mean, this is a guy who perennially finishes top 2. And, his performance was really were propped up by a couple of big games. You know, I think he had a 4-touchdown game against Carolina. He was an uncomfortable quarterback a lot of times last year. You know, he would the memory that really sticks in my mind from watching Aaron Rodgers was him just kind of like dropping back and scrambling around and looking for a guy that might be open, and nobody was open, and scrambling again and like just heaving it to James Jones. You know, that's right. That I feel like that happened so, especially in the second half of the season. He was an uncomfortable quarterback last year.
Well, and that was the memorable Jeff Janis game in the playoffs too. It was several lucky scrambles and throws. I mean, there's talent, but just that uncomfortable, I've got to do something.
Yeah. We can look at Keenan Allen and you know, Phillip Rivers, when after Phillip Rivers lost, I mean, he was the quarterback 2 through week 8, and then he lost Keenan Allen. He was the quarterback 23 the rest of the way. And there were some other factors mixed in there too. I mean, the schedule got more difficult. There were offensive line injuries. Andy Dalton is a great example of a quarterback who's, you know, he was a good fantasy quarterback in 2013. He lost all his guys in 2014, and he was, you know, he was like the butt of jokes in 2014. I mean, everybody thought Andy Dalton sucked at that point.
I thought he was dead.
Yeah. And then last year, you know, Eifert's healthy, Marvin Jones is healthy, Sanu is like their 4, you know, AJ Green has a pretty solid season, and shoot, Andy Dalton was what, like a top 5-6 quarterback in points per game. Kirk Cousins, you know, a guy that maybe doesn't have, you know, an elite skill set, but you put Jordan Reed around him, you know, you give him a solid possession receiver in Pierre Garçon. You know, DeSean Jackson comes back in the second half of the season, and like Kirk Cousins is an elite fantasy quarterback, you know. So I think that the supporting cast is absolutely critical for evaluation of how we should project these quarterbacks going into the year.
Now, Evan, you had mentioned Phil Rivers kind of at the beginning of that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious, we talked about the splits with Keenan Allen, mm-hmm. but what do you see happening with the losses of Stevie Johnson and Ladarius Green? I mean, we know they added Travis Benjamin. We know that Ken Wisenhunt is back there. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's a net gain or a net loss for Rivers altogether?
Well, I think that it's a net gain because he's getting back Keenan Allen and Antonio Gates. And Travis Benjamin, you know, the way that I kind of am viewing him this year is that he'll be a low-volume role player in their offense, but he's also a guy that runs 4-3-6 and can clear space for guys that work underneath, like Keenan Allen and Antonio Gates and Danny Woodhead and Stevie Johnson if he ever comes back. I really like the supporting cast for Phillip Rivers. You mentioned the splits with and with Allen, and that extends just beyond just last season. I mean, over Phillip Rivers' last 39 games with Keenan Allen, he has a 69.4 completion rate, almost 8 yards per attempt, 76 touchdowns, 30 interceptions. In his last 39 games without Keenan Allen, 62%, 7.1 yards per attempt, almost a full yard less per attempt, 67 touchdowns and 41 picks over the 39 games where Keenan Allen has not played. So Keenan Allen, I think there are reasons to believe that he is a difference maker, even though a lot of people will consider him a possession receiver, but he's a super, super efficient possession receiver. And I really like the weapons around Phillip Rivers. And I also like the schedule. The in-division schedule is difficult, although I think that the Chiefs defense might take a little bit of a step back if Justin Houston isn't available. But they do play both South divisions, so that's the AFC South and the NFC South, where you get the Saints and the Falcons. The Panthers will be tough, of course. But then their non-division opponents are Miami at home. The Dolphins go to San Diego. That'll be a great, great week to play Phillip Rivers. And then the Chargers go to Cleveland, which should be a good matchup for him as well. So I think there are a lot of good indicators this year on Phillip Rivers, and he's one of my favorite quarterbacks. If I can get him like 10th, 11th round in a one quarterback league, you know, I would jump all over that.
Do you have any thoughts on the San Diego running back situation? We know that Danny Woodhead has become one of the preferred targets for Rivers out of the backfield, but Melvin Gordon was really disappointing. Do you envision a bounce back for him this season?
I mean, I really don't even – I can't even pretend to know what's going to happen with Melvin Gordon. I mean, I can't, like, look at – based on what we have, you know, including the microfracture knee surgery and including, you know, the fact that he had, I think, 13 red zone touches and Danny Woodhead had 30. All those factors, and it is – it's hard for me to sit here and say that I have any level of confidence in Melvin Gordon. I think that the better debate is – okay, so Melvin Gordon is falling to the eighth or ninth round. That is a situation where, you know what, if he is the player that a lot of people thought he was coming out of Wisconsin, and, you know, this offensive line that I think their starters combined to miss 35 games last year, you know, and we probably think that they're going to have a good offense. You know, the situation is not terrible in theory, but I still think that, you know, when push comes to shove, like, Phillip Rivers trusts Danny Woodhead. And so I think that he has more fantasy value than Melvin Gordon. I mean, as for the running game, I'm sure that they're going to try to make it work with Melvin Gordon. You know, I think Ken Wisenhunt believes in the running game. They had – the Chargers had one of their best running games in a long time, you know, since LT in 2013 when Ken Wisenhunt was the OC. But, you know, it, can Melvin Gordon be as good as Ryan Matthews was that season? Because I know, you know, everybody doesn't like Ryan Matthews, but he was really friggin' good in 2013. And I don't know, I don't have a whole lot of confidence in Melvin Gordon right now.
I am very high on Phillip Rivers this year. He's easily my most owned quarterback in NFL 10s. I think I'm at like 35% or something.
Wow.
And the Allen splits that you mentioned are a big part of it. The offensive line being healthy and improved is a big deal. One question that I get when I tout Rivers is people saying, if he's being drafted as QB 10, does he really have much upside beyond that? Because that's kind of been his ceiling historically. And I think your point about it, his splits where he was the second best quarterback with Keenan Allen, is a huge deal, because that says if this offense is clicking, he really can have that elite upside. I think Keenan Allen, I agree with you, he's an incredible difference maker. And it's remarkable that he's three seasons in and he's, what, 8 months younger than Josh Doctson. That's amazing.
I think that's part of the argument for Gordon as well. I mean, if Keenan Allen does come back and is healthy for the whole year and that passing offense really gets going again, I mean, that could be, you know, the boost that Gordon needs to kind of get his ass in gear and, you know, become the producer we wanted him to be last season. I'm really curious to see how that situation plays out, but I'm not really touching him in drafts.
Yeah, me either. I mean, that stat on the red zone touches, just still every time I look at him, it sticks in my mind, you know. Mm. I mean, in addition to how bad he was, but, you know, if dude isn't going to score touchdowns, if they're going to put Danny Woodhead in there over him in the red zone, you know, I just you need touchdowns, man. It's fantasy football. You need TDs.
Yep.
Right. So sticking with the theme of the weapons around a quarterback really making a difference to his play, I wanted to briefly ask you about Tyrod Taylor. And I say briefly just because Greg and I seem to hit on Tyrod every single week. So our takes have been driven into the ground here. But I know you said at one point that Tyrod was going to be your most owned quarterback this year. And then the Watkins news kind of made it a little more concerning, although Watkins is on the field now as of this recording. So I'd love to hear kind of the update on if you're still super high on Tyrod or where he falls now for you.
Yeah, I am. I don't think he's my highest owned quarterback anymore. I think actually Jay Cutler is, embarrassingly. but I mean, he goes in the 14th round and he's got Alshon Jeffrey, Kevin White, you know, Eddie Royal's coming back. Zach Miller, I think, you know, showed that he can play last year. So, I mean, I take Jay Cutler in the 14th round.
I'm starting to think that he's the perfect QB3 in two quarterback leagues.
Yeah.
If only because he is so cheap. If you just wait for him to be kind of the last guy in that trustable QB3 tier, I think he's going to deliver. Like, we've seen him have success in fantasy before.
He's a guy who could throw 30 touchdown passes, you know? I mean, he's got a lot of good players around. They had horrible luck with injuries last year. And then they just lost their starting center too. But yeah, I've been taking a lot of him. With Tyrod Taylor, You mentioned the Sammy Watkins thing, and that for me is the biggest concern. You know, it's if he loses Sammy Watkins, he's kind of screwed. I mean, he still gives you rushing upside, but I think there were two games last year where Tyrod played and Sammy Watkins did not play, and they were largely a disaster for Tyrod. So that makes him fragile, that he's kind of dependent on one, you know, one guy, because they don't have a whole lot else there. I mean, now we're hearing about Charles Clay still not over the back injury that ended his season. But when Tyrod had Sammy, he was awesome last year. He, you know, there were games in the second half of the season against Kansas City and Houston that at that time, you know, you could argue that Kansas City and Houston were the two best defenses in football when the Bills played them. And Tyrod finishes the quarterback six and the quarterback five in those weeks. So I love seeing that, you know, matchup proof potential. And I also read a great article about play action and how teams use play action from Sterling Z on Football Outsiders. The Bills last season were number one in play action passing in the entire NFL, but they only ranked 24th in play action percentage. So they weren't using it enough. But Greg Roman, their OC, in 2013 and 2014 with the 49ers, his offenses with Colin Kaepernick ranked fifth and sixth in the NFL in play action percentage. So I think we can kind of project growth in terms of play action percentage for Tyrod Taylor. And he throws such a great deep ball, and Sammy can go get it. You know, I think we should see some improvement. And then you got the contract year narrative. And also one thing, Warren Sharp, who does strength of schedule for Roto-World, he has noted that the Bills have the most difficult run defense schedule in football this year. Now, the Bills have a great, great running game where they're so good that I think they can almost impose their will, you know, regardless of opponent. But if they can't run the ball as effectively in certain situations, then that, you know, could help Tyrod Taylor take on more of a playmaking role as a passer and as a runner himself, I think, theoretically. So I think that there are a lot of positive data points with Tyrod Taylor. It's just I think he is a little bit fragile because of the Sammy thing. But, hey, Sammy got out there today, and apparently he was tearing it up. So that's great news.
Right. No, that's a really interesting stat about what Kaepernick was able to do in that offense out in San Francisco. I had not picked up on that, because one of the concerns I've had is more Rex Ryan based than anything, and just low volume and concerns about mm-hmm. defaulting to just pounding McCoy, because that's kind of Rex's default. But that's a good point, that there's a lot more going on than just the head coach calling the shots.
Yeah, we saw Tyrod's rushing volume go up towards the second half of last year too.
Right.
Yeah, and for all of his rushing attempts, like, he's due for some touchdown scoring regression, I think, as a runner.
In a good way, right?
Yeah. Because he had like four or five rushing TDs. But, I mean, he had a ton of attempts. Yeah. And he's a guy who could, I mean, he could conceivably score 7 to 9. And, he's, you know, that will give you big weeks.
Right. No, I think he was one of the top three in attempts for mm-hmm. a quarterback. I want to just circle back to Jay Cutler, because I am so anti-Cutler, I just can't let it go.
I hear you.
So the things that get me, one, the weapons are just kind of a relative unknown. Kevin White should be good, but we just haven't seen it on the field. Zach Miller was incredibly efficient, but also we don't have the track record. And then the running backs that look likely to be a big downgrade from what Matt Forte brought to the offense. And then combining that with the upside that people are looking for, I mean, he's never had a 30 touchdown season in his mm-hmm. career, and he's been playing since 2006. And what I looked at is outside of 2014, which obviously was great, and he and Trestman clicked, and it was a great season. Other than that, he hasn't had 4,000 yards since 2008, hasn't had mm-hmm. 21 touchdowns or more than 21 since 2010. And Jameis Winston just did both of those in his first NFL season. And so to me, well, then you also say that it's not Trestman, it's John Fox, and just the offenses are very different. And I don't know that the upside is there if people think he's a sneaky bet to get into the top 12 at the end of the year. Like, there's some crazy predictions. Whereas if like Greg's point about he as a QB3 that you can get some great value out of for cheap, and yours about getting him in the 14th, 15th round, I don't mind that. It's the people that say he has this tremendous upside. I don't know that I see that.
No, I just like where he's going in terms of draft capital. Like, he's going behind Joe Flacco, Alex Smith, Fitzpatrick, Ryan Tannehill. Like, and that's in our 2 QB ADP. He's essentially very easy to get if you are willing to wait that long to draft him as your QB3. And if he's just backing up, you know, your good starters, I think that he's a fine candidate for that.
Yeah, no, I will be very interested to see what he does this year, because I'm not willing to say he will be terrible. I'm concerned with the hype he's starting to get as a sleeper.
So I don't hear any of that hype, but you know, you run in the two quarterback league circle where they, you know, I mean, they're looking for reasons to prop up guys, probably, right?
Yep.
No, it's true. You're looking at these terrible quarterbacks and hoping, like, can Jared Goff be elite? So one in that mold who I don't think is nearly as much of a stretch, but Marcus Mariota is one that does get a lot of hype, both in one quarterback and two quarterback leagues. And I think he's one that there is a wide variety of opinions on, one that some people say he's probably a top 10 quarterback in points per game. Some that say, you know, he really is still needing time to learn the offense or learn the NFL game, and he's got a new offense coming in. And it seems like there's a pretty wide range as far as what people expect out of him this year. Our two quarterback ADP has him at QB 19, which to me seems like a great price. It seems very cheap for the upside he has, and I don't know that his downside is very much below that. And so to me, the price point is very good, but I really don't know what to make of the Titans offense. And you obviously have dug into it a lot more than I have. So this exotic smash mouth is the phrase that's used. But what I know you wrote about how when Mike Mularkey took over, the quarterback started rushing more. That was one thing that really stood out to me. But what is your feel for what Tennessee's offense and then Mariota as a result are going to look like this year?
Yeah, he had 5 healthy games under Ken Wisenhunt, and he only had 10 rushing attempts in those games. But then when Mike Mularkey took over, and I mean, we're dealing in pretty small sample sizes here, but potential reason for optimism here. Under Mike Mularkey, Marcus Mariota averaged 4.6 rushing attempts per game, so more than doubling what he got under Wisenhunt. Also, he was a guy that I used a little bit in daily fantasy last year. And I mean, he showed some upside, big upside. In the 11 games where he played a majority of the Titan snaps, Mariota had 6 top 10 quarterback weeks, and he had 4 finishes inside the top 6. I don't question his upside whatsoever. It's just, we don't know how this offense is going to go. So I do most of my analysis for one quarterback leagues, and there's this big cluster of quarterbacks from maybe, I don't know, quarterback 11 through quarterback 22, who it's just like, you don't really know how to rank them.
No, it's true.
Yeah. And so I pretty, because I just don't have any clarity with the Titans offense right now, I kind of push Mariota to the bottom. What do you guys think about him?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of with Josh in that I like the upside. I do like the rushing ability that he brings, and I did own him a little bit last year. I drafted him in an auction keeper just as kind of like a stash potentially, and then I started using him in week 2 or week 3 after, you know, he showed that, you know, he was relatively legit. But
yeah,
I do have concerns about that offense. I'm not really sure what exotic smash mouth means. I don't know how many of those receivers are good. It's tough. You're right. That kind of that group of QBs between QB 10 and QB 20 is so tightly packed. Like, who do you take Tony Romo over Mariota? I would. Do you take Tyrod over him? I would. Do you take Matt Ryan over him? I think that's more of a question. Like, I think when you start talking about Matt Ryan, Matt Stafford, Ryan Tannehill, even like Andy Dalton and Kirk Cousins, I think that those are guys who I'm more willing to consider Mariota over just because of that upside we've talked about. But This is kind of why I default to that late round QB style of drafting, even in two quarterback and super flex leagues, is because I don't want to have to choose, because there's like a chance I'll make a mistake. And if I make that choice sooner in a draft rather than later, I pay a higher cost for making that mistake. At least if I wait and just take whoever comes to me three rounds later, the cost associated with that failure is lower. That's my general take. I think that Mariota is fine, but I think that most of these quarterbacks are going to be fine in, you know, any number of weeks.
Right. And for me, it really does depend on what you're looking to get out of him. And so one quarterback versus two quarterback, second quarterback versus third, if he really falls, because he's a perfect like one quarterback stash. I'd love, if I'm taking two quarterbacks, to have him, because maybe he hits, maybe he doesn't, versus in a two quarterback league, if I'm expecting him to start every week, I think that's a lot more risky of a proposition. And I start to question whether, like you said, Greg, whether I should take Matthew Stafford, because we just know the volume is there. And obviously Eric Ebron's injury, we're still trying to figure out the details of that. And there's some moving pieces, but we know he's going to be throwing a lot, and volume is so closely linked to quarterback's fantasy value. And so it really depends to me on what I'm trying to do with my quarterback position and what the league looks like.
Their running back situation in Tennessee concerns me as well. Like, the fact that they signed DeMarco Murray and then went and drafted Derrick Henry does concern me. It makes me think that they just want to run the hell out of the ball all the time. Evan, do you have any inkling about how that situation is going to shake out? Do you expect it to be like a 50-50 split, or something where maybe Derrick Henry takes over partway through the season?
Well, I think you make a good point. They invested pretty heavily in two workhorse running backs. You know, you don't see that a lot, that a team would make pretty aggressive investments. I mean, I think the Titans gave up like a 6th-round pick for DeMarco Murray, but they're paying him a lot of money. And Derrick Henry was a 2nd-round draft pick, a pretty early 2nd-round draft pick. Yeah, that's scary for the prospects of the quarterback, unless he's going to be, you know, he's going to be used like Tyrod Taylor, which I don't know if Mariota is going to be used like that, because this is also a guy that suffered two MCL injuries at different points in the season. And when I look at him, I love him as a player. I mean, I think that he has a chance to be awesome in the NFL, but he's still kind of like frail and kind of growing into his body a little bit. You know, I don't know how durable he's going to be. How many times do you want to run him? You know, as if you put yourself in the shoes of Mike Mularkey, who did run him a pretty good amount last season. But, you know, for a guy that already had two knee injuries, you know, is kind of built like a string bean a little bit, how many times do you want to run him?
Right. It's just the flashbacks to RG3 with great, amazing rookie year, not so great at taking hits, already some knee problems. Like, there's a lot of similarities there.
Yeah.
So let's move on to one other quarterback before we get to Andy Dalton as our spotlight guy, and that's Brock Osweiler. He's currently going as the QB27 in our two quarterback ADP. And Sal Stefanili, another one of the co-founders at 2QBs.com, recently wrote about targeting late round quarterbacks with elite wide receivers, and in this case, you know, specifically mentioning DeAndre Hopkins. Are we underrating Osweiler based on that value he has in throwing to an elite wideout?
Yeah, I think we are. And I don't particularly like Brock Osweiler as a player. You know, I think that a lot of his early game success came on plays that were scripted early in the game by Gary Kubiak in Denver last year. Like, if you look at his first and second half splits, they were just he was atrocious in the second half of games. And I'm not sure if he reads defenses that well. But I think that there are some reasons for optimism on Brock Osweiler. If you look at Bill O'Brien's coaching history, and I mean, coaching histories, you know, we're often dealing with really small samples, and, you know, they can go either way, but you know, they can have relevance or not. But I mean, Bill O'Brien has a pretty nice coaching history. I mean, Christian Hackenberg, he coached him to, you know, people thought he was going to be the number one overall pick in the draft when Bill O'Brien was coaching him. Ryan Fitzpatrick had a pretty decent season in 2014 under Bill O'Brien. Brian Hoyer had his best regular season, was terrible in the playoff game, but had his best regular season as an NFL quarterback under Bill O'Brien. Brandon Whedon even had a big game, and TJ Yates had a pretty decent game against the Jets.
Just a who's who of great quarterbacks you're listening here.
Right. One thing that all those quarterbacks have had working for them, and that Brock Osweiler will too, and this, you know, is kind of still tied into the coaching, but I think I wouldn't expect it to change, is the offensive pace. Because in 2014, Bill O'Brien, his Texans ranked 8th in the NFL in offensive plays per game, and last year they were first. And, you know, Bill O'Brien's got the college background where they put a little bit more emphasis on tempo. And then I like the weapons. I mean, I think the weapons are underrated for Brock Osweiler. Everybody knows about DeAndre Hopkins, but see, I love Will Fuller. I think he's an incredible talent. He's going to drop some balls, but he's going to get friggin' wide open. You know, he will make it easier on other players around him. He will make it easier on his quarterback. And then Jalen Strong, who I think was a pretty good prospect coming out of Arizona State, was immature, but apparently he's really turned it on. He earned more playing time late last season. He showed up to camp in great shape, and it looks like he's actually going to be a starter now. And they've got Cecil Shorts, who, you know, not that great, but a reliable veteran. So if a dude gets hurt, you know, they can plug in Cecil Shorts and they can have a respectable three receiver set. So I think that the weapons are pretty good. You know, the in-division schedule should be pretty favorable for Osweiler. He is going to play in an offense that is going to play up-tempo. I mean, it is going to be in some positive game flow situations because they have a good defense, because they should be able to run the ball. And, you know, if he can have 25, 26 TDs, like, he would absolutely crush his ADP right now. He's a guy that I like to get as a quarterback 3 in MFL 10s, because you can get him like 16th, 17th round. And I mean, I think he's going to have some decent weeks.
Yeah, that's a nice value.
Yeah, just looking, if we kind of patchworked those quarterbacks you mentioned from last year's Texans, it just put all their stats together. They had the 4th most attempts among quarterbacks.
Wow.
And then 17th in yards, 12th in touchdowns. So they weren't good. They didn't do their efficiency was bad. But still, the fact that they got to 12th in touchdowns, and that's comparing them to real quarterbacks, not other teams. So there's some number play there. But these are bad quarterbacks, to your point. Like, I don't like Brock Osweiler. I didn't see anything that makes me think he is a special talent, but none of those 4 are. I mean, Hoyer has had some limited success, but none of them is a good quarterback that can be far beyond Osweiler. If we're really just looking for a comparison, I think last year's Texans quarterbacks are pretty fair. And then, to your point, just with the weapons, Jalen Strong and Will Fuller, they right now are really taking the place of Nate Washington, who last year had just a 50% catch rate. He only had 650 yards. I mean, I think that between the two of them, they're going to be able to put up something that outperforms that. And so whether or not you like Brock Osweiler, I think, like you said, the weapons are there, the volume is there, the offense is there. And so I have personally been trying to find a way to move him up in my rankings just a little bit, still in that QB3 range. But he is a lot more interesting than I had originally thought.
That's same exact way that I viewed him. You know, this is going to be easy to be down on this guy. But then I started to look at him a little bit more, and I was like, you know what? He's going to beat his ADP, you know. And I mean, I think if I recall correctly, if you total together all the fantasy points that the Texans quarterbacks scored last year, I want to say it was like the quarterback 17, which isn't great, but he's crushing his ADP because his ADP is like quarterback 27 or something, you know, or quarterback 25.
It reminds me of Ryan Fitzpatrick from last season.
Ooh.
That's an interesting call, yeah.
That's a hot take.
I mean, just the sense that he was kind of a quarterback that we may have written off to some extent,
yeah.
But the fact that the weapons are there. You know, if Will Fuller does break out like you might expect him to, Evan, and if Jalen Strong does come on, pardon the pun, Strong in his second year, that could be similar to what we saw with Fitzpatrick and Brandon Marshall and Eric Decker last year. Now, I'm not saying that these young wide receivers are on the same level as those two guys, but in an up-tempo offense, in terms of fantasy production, we could see that level of, you know, statistical output from Osweiler. But I just find it so hard to trust him based upon how he looked as a quarterback in that Denver right. system last year that I'm hesitant to move him up my rankings for that reason.
Oh, it could be week four, and it could be like, you know what? The Texans need to bench Brock Osweiler. That's very much
yep.
within the range of outcomes.
Right. No, and that's my big concern. I've gone back and forth with Scott Barrett. He writes for PFF, and he was making the argument that I'm too low on Brock Osweiler, and that's exactly what I said, is I do think there's a lot of potential, but him getting benched and not playing for the second half of the season is very much, like you said, it's in his range of outcomes. I wouldn't say it's likely, just given the commitment they made to him,
mm-hmm.
but it certainly could happen. So let's go ahead and transition to Andy Dalton. I've been excited about this, Evan, ever since hearing how down on him you are, just because he is one of the names that I like this year. And so I will start things off. We tend to focus on one quarterback each week, and we play a game just looking at just our own predictions for what the season will look like for them. So before we dive into analysis, just first, how many top 20 weeks do you think that Andy Dalton is going to have at the end of the season? So QB2 or better.
I think it's going to be like 2014 again. Mm-hmm. And maybe not that bad, you know, like to the point where it was almost embarrassing. But I think it's going to be more like that. I don't know. I mean, I can't give you a good prediction on how many top 20 quarterback weeks that he's going to have.
Okay.
But my take is that I think he's going to be more like 2014, because I think that he, you know, as much as any quarterback, and we discussed even how it affects a guy like Aaron Rodgers and Phillip Rivers. You know, I don't know if Phillip Rivers is a Hall of Famer, but Aaron Rodgers probably is. I think his supporting cast could be bad this year, especially if Eifert can't get it together.
Right. I definitely think the Eifert injury is going to be key. Greg, what about for you? Dalton is, over the last several years, hovered right around 10 top 20 finishes per year. What would you guess for him this year?
Yeah, to Evan's point, I mean, in 2014, he had 11 out of 16 games inside the top 20, and it was the same in 2012 with 11. Back in 2013, he only had 9, but he buoyed that with, you know, 6 of those 9 being top 10 finishes. Just for reference on all that stuff. So I'm with Evan. I'm a little down on Dalton, mostly because of the Eifert loss and the Marvin Jones loss. I think they're going to try to run the ball more. Like, I do worry about the loss of Hugh Jackson just to that team in general. So I'd put it right there, you know, kind of at that baseline of 11 top 20 finishes. I think that's a pretty fair estimate. Like, he only had 10 last year, but that was in 12 games. And he didn't have any, you know, bad weeks outside of the top 24. I do feel like 2015 was the outlier. I know we saw him put up a good year in 2013, but just based on, you know, kind of the up and down trajectory that we've seen from him since 2012, I think 10 or 11 top 20 weeks is about what to expect from Dalton.
Yeah, I think that's fair. He's been pretty consistent in that 10, 11 weeks every year. So maybe the more interesting question, the one where we're going to disagree more, is how often he's going to be a top 10 quarterback, or how often he's going to end up as a weekly QB1. And to just based on your earlier comments, and we'll dig into them a little bit, but Evan, it sounds like you probably don't imagine he'll be a top 10 quarterback very often this year.
I would guess not. And one thing, again, you know, I'm more of a one quarterback league analyst. Like, he's essentially undraftable in a one quarterback league because of the way that he starts in terms of his schedule. He's going to the Jets in week 1. He's going to Pittsburgh in week 2. And then in week 3, he faces the Broncos. So, I mean, you're not really, I mean, I guess you could try to justify using him at Pittsburgh in week 2. That's not going to be a smart move, especially if Eifert isn't back. I mean, that's a situation where you might want to look at the Steelers' fantasy defense. You know, you can't, like, draft a guy in a one quarterback league who you just simply cannot use in the first 3 games of the season. In my top 150, you know, Andy Dalton isn't even in the top 150 because he's not even worth a draft pick as far as I'm concerned.
Greg, just the same question, top 10 weeks, you also are projecting a lower upside this year than last year, correct?
Yeah, I'd expect 4 or 5, and that's about it. I'm worried based on, you know, the schedule and the fact that Eifert, you know, may not be healthy until later in the year.
Yeah, so I'm a little higher than that, not a lot. I think he'll make it 5 or 6 weeks that he'll be a top 10 option. Early on, I do think he'll struggle for the reasons that Evan mentioned. And I'm trying to keep very close tabs on any news or even rumors that come out about Tyler Eifert, because that is a huge factor for me and how I'm going to feel going into season-long leagues that are coming up for drafts. The couple of things that stand out to me is we talked about what is and what isn't the outlier year, and obviously 2014 being the terrible year where he was a laughing stock. And one of the really, well, it was an aberration, an outlier, is Jeremy Hill's yards per carry and just how effective he was on the ground. That year, Jeremy Hill averaged 5.1 yards per carry and moved the ball like crazy. And it just meant that Andy Dalton did not have to do much, and probably shouldn't because he had bad weapons, but also they just didn't need to. The offense was running differently than it had. If you compare that to the other 2 years around it, 2013 and 2015, one was Jeremy Hill, one was Ben Jarvis Green Ellis, but they averaged 3.4 and 3.6 yards per carry. And it really, a lot to me depends on how effective they are going to be in that running game. And I don't know that I think Jeremy Hill is going to be able to repeat that effectiveness. I think we kind of know who Gio Bernard is, and it's more useful in the passing game, which helps Dalton. I don't think that this is a team that just turns into a run-based machine. And I do think that they will keep throwing. So to me, 2014 looks like more of the outlier. I'm not willing to say he has that top five upside like he's looked for periods of his career. But I also am less concerned. Maybe I'm overly optimistic about what LaFell and Tyler Boyd will be able to step in and do. But I do think that if A.J. Green and Tyler Eifert come back, A.J. Green is there, but if Tyler Eifert comes back relatively early, having two elite weapons, I mean, we just talked about what one can do for an offense, but you have two. Mm-hmm. I do think that Andy Dalton still is going to have a lot of very interesting, very usable weeks, although Evan's point is very valid, that they probably won't be in those first several weeks, and so that limits his draftability. I completely agree with that in a one-quarterback league.
Yeah, I mean, I can't disagree with any of that. I think we broke down Andy Dalton really, really well.
Fair enough. So here, that kind of leads me to one of the Twitter questions that the guy's Twitter handle is Fife1919. One of the things he asked is, Evan, do you ever change your mind when consensus is against you on a player, or even if it's just specific people, specific analysts are against where you have a player ranked? So this is different than evaluating and digging into numbers, but just specifically looking at crowd rankings or analyst rankings, does that ever change your view of a player or force you to go back? And if so, are there any recent examples that come to mind?
And this is not like a slight at any analysts. Like, I love fantasy football analysts. I think that they are some of the most hardest working people that I've ever met in real life, talked to on podcasts. They're the best football analysts that there are. But I don't really look at other people's rankings. You know, I don't go look at Mike Clay's rankings. I don't look at, you know, Matthew Berry's rankings. I don't look at anybody's rankings. So, you know, I do drafts. And that can sometimes influence where I want it, where I put a guy. You know, I've done like 90 drafts. I mean, I've done like 70. I think I'm at like 80 MFL 10s. I always have a really good feel for where guys are going in terms of ADP. So when I do my rankings, if I like a guy a little bit more than consensus, you know, I'll put him up a little bit higher than his ADP because I want to get him, you know. But I'll still be mindful of his ADP. I want to try to, you know, maximize all of my picks still, if that makes sense. I mean, I'm really not out there looking at other people's rankings. I think that groupthink certainly still bleeds through, you know, even if you're not looking at rankings. I mean, like last year, Devontae Adams, I think that he was a guy who got pumped up a lot by groupthink. And I mean, it made sense in theory, you know, when Jordy went down.
Yeah, it was kind of intuitive.
Yeah. But it was, you know, we all got it wrong. And I felt like before the Jordy injury, I was a little bit lower initially on Davante Adams than most people. But, you know, I think I got influenced a little bit by groupthink in that specific situation. And it just made sense, or I thought it made sense, that, okay, you know, this dude now has a chance to blow up. You know, he's a guy that you want to draft. Well, I don't know, where did he end up going? Like fourth round, maybe?
Yeah, fourth or fifth, usually.
Yeah, so, I mean, I shouldn't, like, act like I'm blaming groupthink or other people for me getting Davante Adams wrong, because that's not the case. It was my decision. But, you know, it just that was a situation that I kind of regret and hope that I can look back at it and learn from it.
Yeah, and I mean, that speaks to your point about being informed by the drafts that you mm-hmm. partake in. If you start to do these drafts and you start to see Davante Adams going that high, you might jump on board, because especially if it is something that seems intuitive, seems like it makes logical sense. But yeah, you're right. Like in the end, it might be better just to have, you know, a very personal, like film-based analysis or statistics-based analysis of that player, and you just have to stick to your guns. Like the problem is there are just so many unknowns, so many moving parts in this fantasy analysis game that right. you're never going to be right all the time.
No.
Speaking of, you know, making a projection that could very well turn out wrong, our next question comes from Josh Hornsby, this fantasy ADHD on Twitter, and he says, which QB do you think takes the most snaps in Philly this year? Josh, do you want to answer this one first?
I really think that it's Sam Bradford, but I am not confident.
Come on.
Yeah, I know. I'm tempted to say Chase Daniel because I think he's the interesting one, but I don't think that you could put the odds on anyone other than Bradford at this point.
Yeah, same for me. I actually wouldn't be totally surprised if Sam Bradford started all season. And I know that's not a popular opinion. That's not a popular opinion even at RotoWorld, you know, amongst some of our other writers. They think that Carson Wentz is going to be starting at some point, which, I mean, you know, not like that would surprise me. But I think that the Eagles are going to be like a 7-9, really boring team that, like, plays slow, you know, just never get to the point where, okay, you know, our season is over. And now it's time to go to Wentz. I think that they will be, you know, maybe hover around 500, and, you know, Sam Bradford will get most, if not all, the year.
Does that affect your evaluation of Ryan Matthews in that offense? If you kind of expect that sort of season from them, like, is he a guy that you're drafting at all?
He's really not, and I understand why a lot of people are on him. Like Adam Levitan, he's really into Ryan Matthews. And I understand why. I mean, he's a really good back. It's just I think that Darren Sproles is going to be heavily involved. You know, I really don't trust Ryan Matthews to stay healthy. Honestly, I don't trust him to stay healthy. I think that where he goes in drafts right now, I think it's like sixth round. You know, I can get Frank Gore there. I can get Latavius Murray sometimes. He's started to move up a little bit. But I mean, I can wait until the eighth or ninth and get Rashad Jennings, and, you know, just not a guy that I'm drafting a lot right now, Ryan Matthews. But I mean, I understand the argument for him for sure. They could have a good running game. They have a really good offensive line. They have a defense that is really good in the front seven and should put them in situations where they are able to run the ball.
So in your, in your deep leagues, does that mean Kenyon Barner, Wendell Smallwood, or just too uncertain to really even invest a late round
pick?
What about Darren Sproles?
I like Sproles. I like Sproles a lot.
So this is an interesting one. Most redraft leagues don't allow trading of picks, and particularly trading the next year's picks. But just as a thought experiment, Rob C14 on Twitter asked, if you could, would you trade a 2017 first for a 2016 second? So next year's first round pick for an extra second this year if you're in a redraft league. I've never heard of such a thing.
If you knew that the league was going to be disbanded after this year, yeah, trade all your picks. Trade all your 2017 picks.
Why would you ever want to give up your first round pick in a redraft league? This doesn't make any sense to me.
It's that you discount future picks or something.
Doesn't it seem like the situation where, like, if you did this, you could just walk away from the league and then whoever took over your team would just be screwed? Like that.
Right. That's That's why I don't know the league that allows this.
Yeah, you got to get rid of these trades.
So on a more serious question, Evan, this is from Fitz843 on Twitter. If you go into a draft with a mindset that says you're really going to hammer a specific position, so you're going wide receiver heavy or robust RB or whatever it may be this year, at what point are you willing to change gears and really shift your draft strategy just based on the board? And how committed, or I guess the flip side of that is, how committed are you to your plan going in as far as specific team composition you're looking to build?
Say I'm going into a draft and using a zero wide receiver or a zero running back approach. Like, I'm still, you know, marking guys off of my board and understanding, you know, who's available, and not using the little applet on Yahoo or whatever that is, you know. I mean, I'm still very much paying attention to, you know, who do I think the best players left are. So, but I mean, you know, to really execute a zero running back strategy, I mean, you got to start, you know, it all depends on the league settings, but say that you start three wide receivers and a flex and, you know, and of course a tight end. Usually you want to get a tight end within those first five picks, and you definitely want to get four wide receivers. So I think that would be kind of like the cutoff line for when you can start looking at other positions, whether it's, you know, Cam Newton if he falls to the sixth round, or, you know, if you do like Ryan Matthews, or you see Thomas Rawls or Latavius Murray there, you know, available in the sixth round. You know, I think you're still looking at your board and seeing who you really like, even if you are executing a zero running back or zero wide receiver or whatever. You know, even if you're trying to execute one of those strategies, you're still paying attention to the players that you really like. I mean, it's still fantasy football. You want to draft players that you like.
Right, and that's a big difference between DFS and seasonal, is you are keeping a lot of these players all year, so you really mm-hmm. want to pick someone that you believe in at some point.
Yeah.
So our next question comes from John Boot, and Evan, you've kind of talked about how you are mostly focused on one quarterback leagues, but in a two QB league, he asks, are you comfortable with a combo of mid to low QB2s? And if so, who are you targeting? Do you have a good feeling for this question?
So I suck at two quarterback leagues.
I find it hard to believe that you suck at any sort of fantasy, Evan.
No, I haven't played in a lot. The last time I played one was in 2014. And I mean, I did horrible. I don't even think I made the playoffs. You know, it's just a format that I have not played a lot in. And I think in order to really get good at something, you know, you got to like make mistakes and then learn from them.
Right. Well, that's the 80 MFL 10s you're doing, like getting those reps in to just understand the flow of the draft.
Yeah, exactly. So don't ask me for two quarterback league advice or super flex league advice. You know, I could not help you, honestly.
Yeah, stay off our corner.
I would be much more interested in listening to one of you guys answer that, because that's a question that, you know, when I did the draft in 2014, the super flex or two quarterback league draft, I didn't really necessarily know what I was doing. You know, I went and read some stuff by Sal. I didn't really know what. How would you guys answer that question?
Craig, you want to tease your startable QB article? I think that's a great starting point.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I did kind of a deep dive on just the general startability of quarterbacks in those lower tiers. As my dog creeps up on me from behind here, you can hear a tip-tap in the background. And, yeah, I mean, the drop-off in number of startable weeks, and I quantify that by, you know, looking at top 20 weeks. And I think that does apply to 10 team leagues and 12 team leagues, because mm-hmm. even in a 12 team league, if you have a top 20 guy, that means you're better off than even some of the QB2s. And I think that's where you want to be. You want to have an advantage at the position, right? And if you're doing that and you look at these kind of charts I came up with, where you compare like the ADP versus how many top 20 finishes each of these guys gets, the curve is not very steep between, say, like the QB5 and the QB25. It's a pretty flat profile in that space in terms of how many times these quarterbacks are finishing in the top 20. Now, what you get with the early quarterbacks is you get, you know, more elite weeks and fewer bust weeks. But that really only applies to the guys who are drafted in the first round, the top 4 to 6 guys for the most part. And with that in mind, I mean, that just tells me that I do want to wait at the position, right? And if I'm doing that, the guys that I'm targeting this year are kind of the boring or more reliable guys. But at the same time, I'm also just targeting the guys that are going the latest. You know, we talked about this with Mariota earlier, where I kind of just want to wait and just pick up the scraps of whoever's left from that tier of mid to low QB2s. For me, what that means is I'm ending up with a lot of Tyrod, a lot of Tony Romo, a fair amount of like Matt Ryan, Alex Smith, and I talked about Jay Cutler earlier as well. I haven't drafted Cutler a lot, but he's the perfect type of guy for this if he's your QB3. But yeah, I tend to fall on that Romo, Tyrod. I've drafted Dalton a couple times, Matt Ryan a couple times. You kind of have to be, I use this term a lot on the podcast, QB agnostic. You have to not really care which ones you get. And I think that's more important than trying to target specific guys. If I did have to pick out guys that I like more, it's Tyrod Taylor and Tony Romo.
Where are you guys on RG3?
Terrified.
Yeah, officially named the starter, right? That was today's news as we're recording. RG3 named the official starter. So I am 100% biased and I'm a lifelong Redskins fan, so I have a hard time separating my own personal views from him as a fantasy quarterback. I think he is essentially what we talked about with Marcus Mariota. We haven't seen him in this system. He has the same injury risks, the same sort of upside. He has some intriguing weapons around him, but we're still waiting to see. I think he's a very, very risky proposition, but one of the highest upsides for those late round guys.
And I'm kind of terrified of RG3, if only because we haven't seen him do it for so long. Like, I'm really afraid of the downside there. Kind of like we talked about with Osweiler, where what if he does just get benched and Josh McCown becomes the starter? I feel like there's kind of an equal upside there with RG3. I mean, we've seen him be very good in the past, but I'm a little worried that he's just a little too far removed from being a starter, and I'm kind of avoiding him for the most part. Typically, when I'm drafting those lower-end QBs, I tend to gravitate towards the safer, boring guys like Joe Flacco, Jay Cutler, and Alex Smith.
Yeah, I'm just kind of pulling for him because I think the most fun NFL season that I've ever seen was that year that he won Rookie of the Year. I thought that was like the most fun season to watch NFL football. I loved it.
It was so many storylines. It really was a very memorable year just for so many reasons. But yeah, that was what a storybook rookie season.
I know.
And then just the depressing end. I mean, I don't know. If you're thinking in movie terms, it leaves you wanting a sequel. Like, you see a great year and such a sad ending. You really want to see him come back and have another good season. At least I do. Mm-hmm. Well, this has been an absolute pleasure. We really appreciate your insight and you just taking the time to come on and chat with us. Before you go, obviously people know to find you on Twitter at Evan Silva and all your work over at Roto World. But I wonder if you have any upcoming projects or just big draft preparations that people can look forward to over at Roto World.
Every year in mid to late August, I put out a column called the Shy Away 40, which pinpoints a bunch of dudes and tries to give arguments against them for why you should avoid them in your draft. People like it. Every year I'll have like one or two just colossal misses, but it's been pretty.
See, we expect perfection. I don't know.
No, but I mean like league winners, you know, like last year, D'Angelo Williams was in there.
Oh, Andy Dalton was on my avoid list last year. Wow. Which was not a good 2QB take, I'll tell you that.
Oh, yeah. No, I liked Dalton last year because I think he's a guy that is really strongly – how he performs is, like, really strongly correlated to the players around him. But the year before that, I had – this one's so embarrassing. Odell Beckham. Odell Beckham was on there.
Oof. Was that the rookie year when he broke out?
Yeah, man.
Ouch.
But it's usually like I'll usually nail like 1 through 12, and then I'm looking at like late round guys, you know, because I'm trying to get it to 40, So there will be one or two colossal misses, but I think that it'll, for the most part, it'll help people.
So read the column and try to pick out the two misses and draft those guys everywhere.
Exactly.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much, Evan. Yeah. We really do appreciate it.
Thanks, Evan.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on, guys.
So we keep having a lot of content come out at 2QB's quarterback profiles, talking a lot about auctions lately. We had a great guest post by Joe Redeman about 2QB IDP Dynasty Leagues. So rather than dig into all those details, I will say keep checking 2QBs.com. You got to spell it all out, TWOQBS.com. But we are really pumping out the content. It's been nice to read just as a reader. So I write yep. there, but really just some great content. I'm learning a lot from reading, so it's been fun. One thing that we continue to do is mock drafts are starting every Monday this month. So if you're interested in mock drafting with us, we run those on My Fantasy League. They have 8-hour pick timers so that you can draft during a busy work day or school day or whatever you've got going on. But let us know, shoot us a message on Twitter or an email, and we would love to get you in a mock draft.
Yeah, I drafted Gronk in one of those mocks for the first time today. He fell to the third round. Can you believe that?
Wow, that is insane. Yeah, I don't own him much of anywhere, but you got to take him there.
Yeah, I got to start Julio Jones, Allen Robinson, Robin Gronkowski. It seemed like a no-brainer. So we'll see how that draft turns out. I did miss out on, you know, the running backs that I like in those early rounds, but the mock drafts are fun. You guys should definitely get in on those if you can. Otherwise, please rate and review the podcast on iTunes. And again, no idea if you can, but on Stitcher or everywhere else, just rate and review it. You got to do it. I mean, even if you want to, you know, post something on a personal blog or take out an ad in your local newspaper saying that, you know, this podcast is really great. You guys should definitely do that. That would really help us out. You can follow us on Twitter at 2QBs. Same way, you got to spell it out, TWOQBS. Search us up on Facebook. Give us a like there. We'd appreciate it. And for longer form questions, please email us at 2QBs@gmail.com. Josh, we're getting the heavy hitters now, man. Evan Silva coming on the podcast. That was a good episode.
Hey, it's been good. I love really digging into quarterbacks and getting some disagreement. I feel like we learn that way.
Well, and that's how you get to know those ranges of outcomes, right? You can see where smart people are, you know, landing in different spots on different players. And that shows you, you know, how much you have to take into account when you're doing your own evaluations and trying to become your own expert. And so, yeah, just encourage you guys to keep checking out, you know, the podcast, of course, but also all the good content on our site, on Roto World, with Evan Silva and his crew. We want to thank you all for listening. Any parting thoughts here, Josh?
Parting thoughts are how disappointing that we did not get football on Sunday. Who knew that painting a field was so difficult?
That was unbelievable. I was trying to make plans to watch that game and ended up making plans that involved me not seeing it. And then, of course, you know, as I'm driving out to this place, I'm looking at my phone as my wife drives and I see, oh, the game's been canceled. I'm like, well, there you go. I don't know.
Yeah,
what a joke.
Our evening plans changed from watching NFL football to watching women's gymnastics, which that's quite the mental shift. I'm a big fan of the women's Olympic team. Like that's a fun thing to watch, but man, you go from thinking you're going to have people just butting heads and getting concussions to watching a gymnast get a concussion. So quite the transition.
All right. Well, with that said, have fun with your drafts upcoming. Have fun with the Olympics. We'll catch you next time on the 2QB Experience, and we are out of here. Thank you.